You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Susan Kleinberg. Susan, thanks so much for being with me today.
I'm glad to be here.
So, Susan, let's begin with what you're working on now, and perhaps you can tell us what's happening at the Venice Biennale, which you have an installation at right now. Do you want to start with that?
Sure. Yes, I have a piece called Kairos, which I suppose beginning at the beginning. Kairos is a Greek word for which means the moment in time in which something happens, as opposed to Chronos, which is longitudinal time, and that's the title of the piece. It's at the Palazzo Fortuny in a big show that opened May, and it began as a piece I was invited by the team at the Louvre to come develop something. And so this was like being a child in a candy store kind of situation. It took me a while to focus on something that I could actually make.
Tell me what the team at the Louvre invited you to work on. Like, how did that work? That was a residency, or how did that take place? What was that exactly?
Well, one of the people who works with them had seen a piece of mine and asked me if I wanted to come see if I could develop something to actually do there using the facilities, not only of being able to look at the collection, but also with their scientific team.
Okay.
So I came, really it's almost beyond 2 years ago, and ultimately I focused on a beautiful Ishtar, well she's not actually Ishtar, but she's from Babylon, from Mesopotamia. She's Parthian, which means just right about the turn of from the first century BC to AD, and she's a beautiful small statue with a matte set of rubies in her eyes and navel, which were in fact she was the first object analyzed by the Louvre's nuclear accelerator by looking at these rubies, which were found to come from a mine in Burma, which closed in the first century BC, which was how they dated her. And so story on story on story, this seemed to be an interesting way for me to go. She's a very classic feminine figure, made of alabaster with her palm outstretched as an offering. And so I began with that as a reference and working with the Center for Restoration, which is at the Louvre. I was working with their chief physicist, Thomas Collegato, and we began ultimately using this as a reference to film with a very powerful microscope, a Hyrox microscope, into the stone and at its boundary. So that is the original basis for the piece, is this very, very deep excavation through a material which, as you look at it, is never descriptive, and you would not see any kind of reference. But even though I very rarely talk about it, that is the original reference. And so it's really an excavation through material, through time. And I think the idea of using something very, very of the ultimate moment technologically through something so ancient was very appealing. And the macro, micro, of course, was much, much a part of it. I mean, this is almost, at some points, we're shooting almost to an atomic level.
Now, you're talking about shooting through...
we're shooting through
almost
a microscope.
At a step of atomic. So this is a kind of film or photography that I know nothing about, but this is, like, on what level is that you're filming? That seems, I know there's different levels of microscopic, but what are you seeing, and how close is that?
We vary. I mean, really, in a certain way, the piece is a study using perspective as a form in itself and as a metaphor. Is, you know, at what point do you see through? Where do you place yourself in perspective? How do we see perspective? Whether it's geopolitical or personal or social. It's very much involved in the boundary, which much of my work has always been involved in borders and boundaries. So, you know, you see that very clearly. And we vary the perspective, of course, from something that's not so magnified to a very deep magnification. Vary all the various properties that you can work with, which are, besides magnification, light and angles and all kinds of things that, you know, while they are somewhat technical, I hope disappear when you actually look at the piece and it doesn't look in the least bit evident, the form that it's making, which is always a goal to me. And then the sound, I frequently use a sound element when I do these video pieces. And in this case, the sound is the sound of starlight. And it's the sound of starlight coming in through NASA's deep space antenna.
Wow. The sound of starlight. What is that, those sounds? I mean, that's kind of extraordinary and about as big as you can get in terms of kind of opposing perspectives. What is that sound, and what is the sound of stars? Like, that's kind of fascinating.
Yes, it's absolutely fascinating. It's very unpredictable. It's a kind of, you know, I don't know. I don't think I can make you the sound of stars on the telephone, but I mean, it's kind of a punctuated sound, and then there'll be times when there's no sound, and then the tone will change. And so it is the actual sound. It's not edited. And yes, but it's an interesting thing because in a certain way it's a very organic sound. People have said when they've watched the piece that they felt that they'd heard this sound before. And in a certain way it's a very primal sound. And it's a kind of interesting thing because I think one thing that I found that was originally amusing is that it sort of sounds like, you know, what old 50s space movies had, as, you know, like, that kind of sound.
Right.
So, you know, it's just, you know, art imitating life, life imitating art, who knows? But, you know, while it's not quite that, it is a spacey sound.
And so at the Palazzo Fortuny in Venice, you're installing a digital projection with sound. That's the result of that?
Yes, it is a projection with sound in a fairly enclosed space, a beautiful arching space, so that the resonance of the sound as well as visual imagery is quite focused. And people come in, you hear the sound going quite a bit through that area of the museum, but when you come in, it's quite focused and people can sit and watch the piece.
And it's almost entirely abstract. Is that correct? Like, we don't actually see that little figure that it was based on.
No, you don't see any kind of a reference. But in fact, it is important to me that it is not per se, you know, it is not generated as an abstraction. It does come from something as a real reference.
So let's move back a little bit. I'd like to go through a few of your shows and talk about a little bit how this kind of way of thinking came about. We can go back as far as you want to childhood or when you were coming out of school. When was it that you first got involved in the arts?
Well, I was a child in Arizona, so I drew a lot of pictures. Usually I drew pictures of environments. And then ultimately I went to Pomona College, which at the time had a very good art department. Lots of artists have come out of Pomona, from Chris Burden and Jim Terrell. And I was sort of, our teacher was a wonderful man named Maury Baden. And we all kind of came out of this very conceptual background and very much sort of reference of thinking for yourself and adding and subtracting and looking a little bit further. And I'm kind of the younger end of that, but I was really lucky to be part of it. And in a way, I was making things all over the place. And at one point, John Baldessari said, "Oh, that's interesting. You know, that looks like art. I was going to be a philosophy major." And so then I've been making paintings and drawings, as I still do, that always relate to these pieces. And
I'm sorry to interrupt, but after you decided that looks interesting, you know, you'd like to make art, what age was that? When was that?
In college.
And so then what happened after that? Did you you switch your major in college to art, or how did that evolve?
I had an art philosophy major, which was very much in keeping with the tone of what was going on there. It was a very strong philosophy department as well. And so I continued, and I was working in a bakery decorating cakes, so I had, you know, already a little kind of foothold in the real world. And then I went to graduate school at Hunter. I was Tony Smith and Robert Morris's graduate student, and basically I just continued making work. And
so let me stop you there for a minute. I mean, I heard Tony Smith was a wonderful teacher, kind of a remarkable guy in terms of talking about philosophy. That I ever heard that Tony Smith was a remarkable teacher, a wonderful guy in terms of how he approached it philosophically.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And
so what were you making there?
And Robert Morris also, and you know, the whole,
right.
You know, it was very loose and very self-directed. I mean, it was very unschooly, which was just what I wanted. So I just really continued making work through a large range of media, really. All those, I've used media as a tool, just learning what the media is as it seemed appropriate to the work, and continued and was living in New York, and continued on through up until I hadn't per se been interested in making video work, but I was doing a piece about courage, where I spoke to all kinds of people about courage. This was in 1998. Beginning with firemen, running, asking people, what do you think courage is, running through Congressman John Lewis and Chuck Close and Leon Golub and Madeleine Albright and Sally Ride and Gore Vidal.
Asking them all the same question?
Pardon me?
You were saying you were asking them all the same question.
About courage, yes. And so they were conversations in a very loosely structured way. And I wanted to do the piece just as a sound piece, which ultimately came to Harold Zeman's attention. And we did it at the 2001 Venice Biennale. And I had been taking pictures of everyone just myself, very random, simple photographs. But he loved them, and he wanted to include them, and I absolutely did not want to include them. And so that
you mean he wanted to include photographs of people you had asked that question?
He wanted to include the photographs that I'd taken. Generally, I would take, like, if I was in John Lewis's office, which is an office that has, you know, great mementos of the civil rights era everywhere. I would photograph around the office and then just very casually with the person. So to not, he was a person who was hard to say no to. So I thought, okay, what can I do? I don't want to tack the photograph to the wall. So I, this was in 2000, so I thought, okay, I could link them on video with the sound and marry them that way, which is what I did. So that piece was a succession of still photographs with the audio. And that was kind of how I segued into using a video medium.
So and that's fascinating. And just to back up a little bit, because I think we went over like several years pretty quickly, your art career has begun, you've graduated, you have a graduate degree. Where did that project fall in line? I mean, that was one of your bigger projects, would you say, this idea of talking to all these people and asking them about courage, which in itself seems enormously ambitious, reaching all those people that you mentioned. They're all kind of huge figures in government, politics, writing, the arts. Was that
well,
one
I also
of...
talked the piece they used, the edit we used in Venice included all those people, but primarily, of course, I talked to very simple people, and their answers were just as interesting as, in many ways, more well-known people. And then I also, for Venice, I did an edit in Italian also. I do speak Italian, and that in some ways is even more interesting because it was done fairly quickly, and it's more people, fish vendors and gondoliere, and it did include Berlusconi. But it has been a really amazing project. I still continue it, and it proved a complete surprise, really a surprise of a project. I never really anticipated that it would become so large, and ultimately it was probably, kind of a gift to me, and then 9/11 happened, and then it was distributed really all over. We distributed it all over, just made it available, and it went to schools and hospitals and such like that.
And before that work, were you showing in New York? Were you exhibiting in New York already in the decade before? We're talking about the 90s now, or I'm talking about the 90s?
Yeah, and I was really lucky, in a way, because of Tony and such. I was making paintings, kind of odd-looking, in a way, all my work always looks the same. And always excavating through, and I was making paintings and drawings, and then I had a show with Castelli, so that was kind of an opportunity to have a little view of what was going on in the actual art world.
You said Sean
and
Kelly. That was the gallery.
Leo Castelli.
Oh, Leo Castelli. Wow. So that was. And that was one of your first big shows in New York, or?
Yes.
Okay, because that's quite a gallery to get into for your first gallery. That was one of the best galleries in the city.
Oh yeah, it's spoiled me forever.
So how did you get into that gallery? Why that gallery first? How did they find you, or how did you get into Leo Castelli?
He was really a wonderful person, and I had come to know him because of working for Tony Smith and Robert Morris. And he used to like to look at the work of young artists. And so one certainly wouldn't say no to an opportunity like that, and I was very lucky to have a little time with
that sounds like that really began to launch your career. Would that be correct? That gave you a larger stage and brought you into the fold of the art world? Yeah. And we're kind of going back and forth, but in the next 10 years, or I guess it was, I forgot, when did Castelli die? Right around 99 or 2000?
Something like that, yeah.
So for the next 10 years you were showing with him and selling work there? Were you moving into being a full-time artist then?
I was always a full-time artist. I did various little jobs, but I taught and such like that, but primarily I was making work pretty much all along.
Right, but there was commercial success with Leo Castelli, I would imagine, as well.
Yeah, sometimes better, sometimes worse.
Right. So then we're moving forward. You've been showing with him. It's 2001, 9/11, but how did that first invitation to the Venice Biennial happen? That would seem like another kind of major point. That is for any artist, but that was the first time you were invited to the Venice Biennial in 2000, was it?
I did do a piece. I had been at the American Academy in Rome, and I did do a piece that was one of the events that they were doing. It was a piece that floated in the water. It was for the 100th anniversary of the Venice Biennial, and they asked artists from different countries to do pieces. And so I had done a piece then. That was in 1995. And
what was that for exactly? Because it's kind of interesting. Like the Venice Biennial, we always think of it as people representing their countries, but There are all these other ways of being in there. In 95, that was a show where in the Venice Biennale? It was in the main pavilion, or how does that work?
It was a show where they asked people, they asked an artist from more or less various countries to do pieces which would float in the water. It was the 100th anniversary of the Venice Biennale. This was in addition to all the other things that are going on. And so I made this piece called the Sposalizio del Mar, which was based on when you look at the great Canaletto's or many of the kind of most classic Venetian paintings, there's an image of the Doge in a beautiful boat throwing a ring into the sea. And this was one of the major ceremonies of the Venetian Republic, and I used it in terms of symbolizing the interconnectedness of civilization and nature and such. And so I had this big flotation car that floated in the water, laden with all kinds of objects, tossing up and down in the waves. And so that was 95. And then, and you know, that got some attention, but not such a big, you know, it was a good thing to do, that's for sure. And then the Courage piece I started working on, and I was just really working on it, and I didn't really expect it to have any traction at all in the art world because, you know, what could be less cool than a piece about courage? But in fact, it did. So I don't actually remember how it first came to Zeman's attention. But then we met, and he wanted to do it, and so we did.
That's interesting, as you're saying, like, you know, whether that's cool or not, a piece about courage, you know, but we're also talking about a time in the art world that's right around and post 9/11. Do you think that was
The piece was begun before 9/11.
Right.
I mean, the piece that and it showed in Venice in June, and you know, of course, that was when it was in September when 9/11 happened, and so, you know, I certainly didn't have any intention of being prescient, but there it was.
Well, and in a sense that, you know, perhaps that kind of ethic or that idea was even more in demand. I mean, it's interesting, as you say, I'm kind of trying to touch on, you know, what's cool or not cool about that project in the art world. And did you say that as kind of, you know, like initially thinking about what is, as you mentioned to me just earlier in this talk, you know, what could be less cool than doing a project about courage? Why did you think that? Doesn't it seem, in a way that seems wonderful, but are you saying it wasn't ironic enough or too straightforward? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, sort of always I've done whatever work I was going to do and didn't think too much about any kind of measure. And I was doing this piece and I was going to do it no matter what. And yes, it's certainly not ironic. It's very direct. And yeah, I mean, didn't seem not particularly, you know, definitely lacking in irony, maybe not too hip, you know. And but very, I mean, it became a real key, and it was incredibly interesting and drew enormous quantities of people watching it, and this is before 9/11.
And after 9/11, it must have had another type of life, because we are now the post 9/11 world, talking about courage, which I imagine would change the tone of it or the context.
Well, it went to PS1. It went to quite a number of places after. At PS1, it stayed in the lobby for a very long time. Went to the museum in Buenos Aires. It went a lot of places. And yes, I think it, you know, had personal resonance. And I mean, I think with much of my work, I've always made fairly complicated work where people can enter and place themselves as they do. I'm not big on a real didactic approach. And I think that piece, as with any painting I make, allows people various ways in. And modes to see for themselves and relate to the questions that I hope I'm posing. But, you know, I think the posing of questions is pretty much quite basic to my work through any of these media.
And then let's just move forward to the other things that happened. So then there was, it's 2002, you were invited to the Venice Biennial again, for a different reason, right? You, first, the artists who were, you invited artists who were making things on, that had to do with the water, and then there was more times you were invited to the Venice Biennial, wasn't there?
Well, actually, the water was beforehand. That was 1995. The Zeman Biennial with the Courage piece was 2001. Then I did it. I did a really big projection called Blood Roll. I did that with the Istituto Veneto. That was a big projection. I mean, I've done other things besides in Venice, but since we're talking about Venice, that was a piece that was based on, in fact, on the war in the Balkans. And the imagery, which most of this imagery has been in the video pieces, has been digitally generated. It was a large glass globe that rolled very slowly, intensely on a track over a central fulcrum, always against any predictable laws of physics or gravity. And it spins against, as it should, and it's all quite subtle, but it's quite disturbing. That particular piece was filled with a substance that looked like it would have weight and be blood. And then it would spin, and then there was this deep soundtrack, creaking and, you know, sloshing. And that was great because it went all through the streets, and it was like the Pied Piper would draw people to come towards it. And, yes, that was, and it was projected on the facade of a building that was covered with a scrim, a great building that was a center of, sort of like the Smithsonian, a center for scientific research and literature. So in terms of those outdoor projections, I like the fact that whatever I'm using, of course, can include the context of the projection surface.
It's fascinating. Yeah, it's a beautiful project. And then...
And also, just as long as we're talking about it, that came out of, that was during the Balkan War, and Balkan, the translation is blood honey, and those were the colors of the piece. It was kind of honey-colored. And, well, that may not have been, you know, so obvious, that certainly, I mean, all was stories of how these pieces come to be and what they are is always important to me, and that was certainly very much a part of it.
Well, in that piece, I mean, you know, it's gorgeous, visually evocative, it's huge in Venice. Do a
yeah,
lot of people understand
38 feet wide.
Huh? Right, so that's pretty huge. Do a lot of people understand the references to that and the Balkan War and everything? Or because it's such a powerful visual piece and huge, how do people know more about the references and how that piece began?
Well, there was quite a lot of writing about it, of course, at the time, and there was also some description of where, you know, on the wall underneath the piece. But also, I think it, you know, it was a fairly disturbing piece. Although, also, I remember someone walking through and saying that she discovered she realized she was pregnant when she was watching the piece. So, you know, you could read. I hope. You can frequently read my work a lot of different ways, and one is no more essential to me that you should react one way than another. I'm delighted with multiplicity of reactions.
And so this brings us up to the present. You were in the Venice Biennial. I mean, between then and now, again, and then currently you're in the Palazzo Fortuny and. And the work's being shown, and how is that being received there?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I never expected there to be quite... I mean, I was in the show that they did there, the same team, Axel Verwoerd and Daniela Ferretti, 4 years ago, and that was really wonderful. But this one seems to be really full of people, and people with very interesting comments and very engaged and seems to be calling up a lot of questions. People have a lot of questions, interesting, unpredictable questions. So it's been, I mean, I haven't been there for, you know, I was there for to install in the beginning. I haven't been there for a while. But there continues to seem to be a lot of people there, and it's been a great experience, and it's interesting to be in the show with such a, there's a wide variety of work and different artists in the show. You know, it's interesting to me to see the variety that's there, and I've been, you know, really happy to be a part of that.
Well,
and
Susan,
right now,
I'm making
paintings. That actually, right now, I'm making a group of new paintings that have to do with that imagery, and so that's a nice continuation, and also a group of new prints.
And where will those prints and paintings be shown? Are you, do you have a gallery in New York now? Are you represented now, and will those be exhibited?
Yeah, they will be exhibited. The next thing I'm doing is actually in Berlin, and in terms of the next gallery thing, I'm kind of in between that a little bit. But, yeah, I'm just sort of starting work actually then on another big piece, and which will be about pressure. And I'm seeing all kinds of sounds of pressure and imagery that's being generated from lots of different sources. And a lot of times when I start, I do start making all kinds of drawings, which is something I'm doing right now.
Susan, it's really been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Of course. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.